Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I'm excited. Two reasons for tonight's author. One, I always like folks with Colorado ties because there's such a diverse and deep talent pool in a state that's not that big. So we are mighty, even though we may be small. The second thing that is I'm excited about is in reading the book. I always like those books that kind of maybe explain those things that happen when we can see things change only when we look back in the long, over the long view. And maybe all those things are changing all along, but we just don't see it at the time. So tonight is the new book by tonight's author, A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars by tonight's author, Andrew Hartman. And I'm going to ask you to help me bring him up to the microphone. So please join me in welcoming here.
Hello, thank you very much for coming out tonight. I got to say that this is surreal because I do this quite a bit lately and I've gotten used to it, but I'm certainly not used to doing it in front of you all. Many family and friends in the audience here tonight, including my mom. Where are you, Mom? Okay. So, you know, a lot of people with whom I've grown up with, and so this is a little bit surreal. It's like my two worlds colliding. Since this is my hometown crowd, I thought it would be nice to give a bit of biography on how I came to write this book, which, as you know, is a history of the culture wars from the 1960s up till the present. Being sort of a quintessential child of the 80s, I remember some of the events in the book, not too clearly, but I do remember some of them. Of course, Ronald Reagan figures large in the book as being the first president to sort of ride the wave of a newly mobilized Christian right into the White House. Ronald Reagan was president for me from the ages of about 8 until 16. And so it's a formative period in my life. My very first political memory is from the night of the 1980 presidential election when Reagan defeated Jimmy Carter fairly handily. My family, so I'm 8 years old, my family attended an election party at the house of my parents' good friends, Alan and Barb Olds, who I see just walked in at the back. It was sort of a traumatic experience for an 8-year-old because all of the adults seemed so sad. Not a lot of Republicans in that crowd. I think I saw some tears. Not as many tears as a few years earlier when the Broncos lost the Super Bowl, but a few. I have other memories that I now realize were from the culture wars that I write about. My longtime friend, Dave Bennett, who I think's coming, but I don't see him here yet, so he got caught in traffic. He'll be here soon, and so he's missing his call out. When I was about 10 years old, he introduced me to the lyrical stylings of Two Live Crew. This was, I think, unbeknownst to my mom. Two Live Crew was brought up on obscenity charges in Miami for performing their extremely raunchy sex songs, which I detail at length in chapter 6 of my book. There was something so exciting about being a 10-year-old and listening to music that we knew was taboo, that we should not be listening to this music. And so as I was researching that chapter, I was kind of excited by that fact. Tipper Gore and others argued that this music was going to sort of warp our minds. Somehow, we turned out okay. At least Dave did. He's a dentist. I mean, can you imagine a more respectable profession than that? And Dave missed his big moment. But aside from such memories, the culture wars did not really shape my life or worldview in any conscious ways until the mid to late 1990s, when I attended Metro State College right here in Denver to obtain my certification to be a high school social studies teacher. At Metro, I took a I took courses from a number of wonderfully provocative teachers who started me down a path that I think I'm still traveling. None more so than the legendary Charles Angeletti, who is here. I think Charles has been teaching at Metro for close to 50 years. Is that right? Okay. So he is an institution. Charles taught my methods course, and he was the first person to introduce me to the idea that teachers should not be objective, rather teachers, if we're so inclined, should be political activists, or it should be our mission to sort of get our students to think about the world in politically conscious ways. Charles also introduced me to the works of the radical historian Howard Zinn, whose every book I quickly read as he became something of a hero to me, and perhaps one of the reasons I decided I wanted to go to graduate school in history. So we can blame Charles for all of that. Zinn plays an important role in my book as being the great popularizer of social history, or what many people call history from below. He and a group of others were some of the first to tell the story of the people, the working class, racial minorities, women, not just our political and economic elites. But that type of history, which has become increasingly popular since the 1960s, has created one public controversy after another, including right here in Colorado with the recent controversy in Jefferson County. So these things are still with us. After getting certified to teach, I got my first job at Thornton High School, where my mom had long taught. Who said nepotism is dead? My time there was short-lived, as many of you know, and I'm not going to go into the reasons for that because my mom is still bitter about it. Let's just say that I took this political activist side of teaching a little too seriously. Thank you, Charles. At least too seriously for the school administrators who decided that they were not going to renew my contract. The 2 years I spent teaching at Thornton, though, were hugely formative in my life. I learned some hard lessons. I learned firsthand that teaching history to children is very serious business, or at least people take it very seriously. Both of the books I have written in one way or another have sought to investigate this lesson. So I've tried to put this traumatic experience of losing my job in a larger historical context. I guess you could say that I decided that this was the best way to learn from my mistakes. And so with that, my first book, Education in the Cold War, which was based on my dissertation, explores the way Americans variously experienced the crisis, the political crisis of the Cold War, as a crisis in education. Politics was everywhere in the schools during the Cold War. I think it still is, but especially pronounced during the Cold War. Whether it was in shaping the curriculum in order to prepare young Americans to better fight the Cold War, or whether it was because many thousands of teachers lost their jobs for having the wrong political views. And so now to my second book, which I'll spend the rest of tonight talking about, A War for the Soul of America. This book builds upon those lessons, but also spans outward to think about why Americans are so divided in the ways we think about culture, the way we think about education, film, television, art, music, literature, this list goes on. So to me, it was extremely interesting that Americans debated furiously Martin Scorsese's 1988 film, The Last Temptation of Christ. It was an interesting question to ask. Why do Americans care so much about this film? I think you can, if any of you have seen the film, you might understand why it was so controversial. Scorsese, having grown up a Catholic, was extremely interested in exploring the more human sort of elements of Jesus Christ or the Jesus Christ story. And so in exploring the human elements of the temptation of Jesus Christ, he focused a great deal on Jesus being tempted by sex. And a lot of people, of course, not surprisingly, reacted pretty negatively to that. So my purpose tonight is to introduce you to the book. I'm going to describe what I mean by the culture wars because I realize that not everyone understands exactly what is meant by that term. And I'm going to describe my thinking on the history that gave us the culture wars. And then finally, I'm going to tell you a quick case study on the culture wars, the national debate about how we should learn U.S. history, which I chose because I think it's still so relevant today, as you can see in nearby Jefferson County. When the longtime political activist and conservative Patrick Buchanan declared a war for the soul of America. I stole my title from him. During his rowdy speech at the 1992 Republican National Convention in Houston, he was restating a theme that had defined his underdog campaign during that year's GOP primaries against George H.W. Bush, who was president, of course, at that time. This theme was the culture wars, a struggle, in Buchanan's words, as critical to the kind of nation we will one day be as was the Cold War itself. And so he's really elevating the stakes of these culture wars. With such urgent rhetoric, Buchanan wanted to raise the stakes not only of the culture wars, but of that year's presidential election. More than a choice between Bush and the Democratic challenger Bill Clinton, and of course Hillary, Buchanan never tired of mentioning that if you elected Bill Clinton to the White House, you also got Hillary. We're still sort of in that moment, I think. More than just that choice, the nation was confronted with a decision, in his words, about who we are, about what we believe, about whether, quote, the Judeo-Christian values and beliefs upon which this nation was built would survive. This speech by Buchanan punctuated a series of angry debates that dominated national headlines during the 1980s and 1990s. These debates came to be called the culture wars, so that's the topic of my book. The list of divisive issues that helped define the culture wars is long, so let me just say a few, and I detail all of these at length in the book. Abortion, affirmative action, controversial art and art censorship, evolution, family values, feminism, homosexuality, intelligence testing, multiculturalism, national history standards, pornography, school prayer, sex education. This list goes on and on, but those are some of the most important. The issues at stake in these culture wars, I argue, were real and compelling. Such a straightforward notion, in fact, defies this well-worn argument that was put forward by Thomas Frank in his 2005 book, What's the Matter with Kansas? I really like reading Frank normally. I think he's this excellent and cranky writer who focuses most recently on criticizing our celebration of capitalism. But I disagree vehemently with his book, What's the Matter with Kansas, because he argued that the culture wars were superficial and helped make our politics irrational. So he wrote this, and this was published in 2005, and sort of high on his mind was the 2004 election of George W. Bush. For Frank, he could not understand why Americans would have reelected Bush. And so he was trying to make sense of this, and that's why he turned to this issue of the culture wars. So to give an example, Frank relates the controversy over the artist Andres Serrano's blasphemous piece of art, Piss Christ, which was a 1987 photo that he took of a crucifix that was submerged in a jar of his own urine. I can't imagine why that would be offensive to anyone. Frank relates this to his thesis that the culture wars get the good. Quote, because some artist decides to shock the hicks by dunking Jesus in urine, the entire planet must remake itself along the lines preferred by the Republican Party. So he's extremely dismissive here of a number of different people. And his argument really goes as follows. Religious conservatives often voted against their own economic interests due to an illogical obsession with the culture wars. He would argue that Republican politicians didn't really care about the culture wars, but they were sort of cynical and lent rhetorical support to these issues as they focused on more important matters to them, such as rewriting the tax codes in favor of the rich. So Frank was a liberal, and he grew up in Kansas, and he's disturbed by these developments in his home state. Kansas by then had gone very conservative, but he's also disturbed by these developments in the larger nation. His fellow Kansans, his fellow Americans, were defying his expectations that they direct their anger at the wealthy, or at those who were responsible, he thought, for making their economic lives so precarious. By this logic, for him, debates about the culture wars, or the debates about the idea of America, which is really what I think the culture wars were about, were just sideshows. It was all bread and circuses. But my argument is different. So the history of America, for better or worse, sometimes worse, is largely a history of debates about the idea of America. ever since the nation's founding, St. John de Crèvecœur, who is this one of many French people who came to the U.S. in the early stages of the nation to sort of explain the United States to Europeans because we were this this weird anomaly. He wrote this 1782 book in which he asked, what then is this American, this new man? But I think we're still debating that question. Disputes over this question have served as the battleground of American cultural conflict ever since. And such disputes become much more intense during times of rapid change. So this very tumultuous period in American history known as the 60s was just such a time. The 60s gave birth to a new America, a nation more open to new peoples, new ideas, new norms, and new, if conflicting, articulations of America itself. This fact, more than anything else, helps explain why the nation grew more divided during and after the 60s than probably at any other period in American history since the Civil War. The Civil War, Americans were pretty divided. The history of the culture wars offers insight into this genuine transformation to American culture. So that, in a nutshell, is the larger purpose and argument of my book, that the 60s were a cultural revolution and that we continue to debate and fight that revolution, we continue to live out its legacy. And like I said, this is my big historical argument. It's not necessarily new, but I think it bears repeating, that things dramatically changed during the 1960s. So that said, to say as much is not necessarily to argue that all of these changes were brand new to the 1960s. So for example, the 60s counterculture, this is the ethos of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This grew out of earlier sensibilities that you might have found, for example, in the 1950s beats, or beatniks, their critics called them. People like Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac, who brought this counterculture, what they like to refer to as bohemia, to the masses with their unconventional poems like Ginsberg's Howl or like Kerouac's On the Road. So on the other side of the spectrum, those who supported the violent police crackdowns on protesters at Berkeley, many of which the police were often set upon such protesters by then-Governor Ronald Reagan, who called Berkeley a haven for sex deviants who needed a good lashing. In my book, Reagan was always good for a good quote. Such conservative attitudes really emerged from much earlier sensibilities. For example, you might have seen it in the protests in the 1950s when Elvis Presley appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show and sort of did his pelvic gyrations. So what indeed then made the 60s new? Most crucially, the radical political mobilizations of that era. Civil rights, Black and Chicano power, feminism, gay liberation, the anti-war movement, the legal push for secularization, these movements destabilized the America that millions of Americans knew and understood, and it was extremely sort of anxiety-inducing to them. It was only after the 60s that many Americans, particularly conservatives, recognized a threat to their once great nation. It was after the 60s when whether one thought the nation was in moral decline was often directly related to whether one was a liberal or a conservative, left or right. A political scientist said, he called the 60s something of a political Rorschach test. Tell me what you think of that period, he wrote, and I shall tell you what your politics are. Sometimes I think this is still true. Those who argued that the 60s sort of threatened the very fabric of the nation tended to be conservative. They tended to believe that they had this sort of notion that the nation was in decline, and oftentimes, although I think they were quite hyperbolic in describing this decline, overstated, I think they were more or less accurate. An older America had indeed been lost. So this is where, in fact, conservatives get the 60s right. This doesn't mean that you or we have to necessarily agree with their notion that the 50s were better than the 60s, but we should recognize that they were right, that things were changing. In their eyes, things were falling apart. So in the nearly two decades between the end of World War II and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. This is the what historians call the long 50s, or just the post-war period. A cluster of powerful norms, conservative norms, set the parameters of American culture. These cultural standards are best described by the phrase, this sort of very academic phrase that I came up with, and I can hear my wife Erica saying, tone down the academia. This is an analytical category I use to, I call it normative America. It's an analytical category I use to refer to a group of assumptions and aspirations that were shared by millions of Americans during the post-war years or during these 50s. Here are some of these values, and many of us still prize these values, but they were especially prized during that era. Hard work, personal responsibility, individual merit, delayed gratification, social mobility, and then other values that middle-class whites would have recognized as their own and recognized as American values. They lived according to stringent sexual expectations. So sex, whether it was for procreation or recreation, was to be confined within heterosexual marriage. Americans behaved in ways consistent with strict gender roles. So within the confines of this heterosexual marriage, men worked outside the home and women stayed home and cared for the children. Television more or less conformed to a lot of these expectations and even at times promoted them. You can think of shows that have been serialized and are still sort of repeated all the time. For example, Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver. I grew up watching Leave It to Beaver because it was one of my father's favorite shows, and he introduced me to Leave It to Beaver. Is it still on? It probably is. You might also think of the imagery of a Norman Rockwell painting as representing this 1950s America. 50s Americans believed that their nation was the best in human history. Those aspects of American history that shined an unfavorable light on the nation, such as slavery, were ignored or explained away as sort of aberrations or bad apples. Such Americans often assume that the nation's Christian heritage demonstrated its unique character. The United States of America really was a city on a hill, which John Winthrop said in the 17th century, and which Reagan often repeated. These cultural norms of the 50s were more pervasive, perhaps more coercive, than before or since. An unprecedented number of Americans got in line, or at least tried to get in line. They aspired to get in line, particularly white, heterosexual, Christian Americans. Even those Americans who were barred from American identity by virtue of their race, sexuality, or religion were often compelled to demonstrate such compliance. In part, such an extraordinary degree of conformity had to do with the Cold War. A global struggle against an alien communist system required such cultural stability. There's this enemy out there, we have to be united against it. But even more, the cohesiveness of this American culture, I argue, was a byproduct of these internal threats to it. Threats that might have always been present but didn't really become clear until the 60s. It's as if people who had cultural power, people who had privilege, recognized that such power and privilege was a house of cards ready to crumble at any time. So President Nixon expressed the overwhelming anxieties that many people had about this in his second inaugural address in January 1973. And I'll just quote Nixon because I can't say it better than him. Above all else, although I can't do Nixon impersonations, so I like him though. Above all else, the time has come for us to renew our faith in ourselves and in America. In recent years, that faith has been challenged. Our children have been taught to be ashamed of their country, ashamed of its role in the world. At every turn, we have been beset by those who find everything wrong with America and little that is right. Simply put, the nation that Nixon loved was in distress, and he believed that returning to the values that animated the nation in the 1950s was the best way to save the nation. So in short, the 60s divided us. Those on the left tended to view American life through the eyes of the activists who sought to change America, through the eyes of feminists, racial minorities, gays and lesbians, secularists, all those whose very existence sort of represented a symbolic threat to this normative America. For them, American culture had always been dangerous. It had always been fractured. There was no sort of whole or wholesome America because they were barred from it. And so they sought to make the nation better. Indeed, American culture after the 60s grew more feminist, more secular, more pluralist, and less racist. This was a new America that those on the left identified with to some degree. So we can now better understand the major debates of the culture wars through this historical lens. And so all of the debates that I detail in the book sort of funnel through that historical lens. But now I'd like to focus in on one of those debates, and that's the debate over how Americans should learn about our nation's history. So those who identified with the 1950s, those who tended to be on the right, the political right, conservatives, they wanted people to learn a version of U.S. history that was much more of a celebration of American exceptionalism, this notion that the United States is the best country that has ever existed and is different from other countries. Those who identified with the 60s, so those on the left, tended to think that such a version was a whitewash. This divide grew to enormous proportions by the mid-1990s, when a host of controversies about American history and the teaching and sort of memorialization of American history rocked the nation. The biggest of such debates was over the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum's attempt to display the Enola Gay bomber, the plane used to drop an atomic bomb on Hiroshima at the end of World War II. Although the Enola Gay better symbolized American military power than perhaps any other war relic, it was never displayed prior to 1995, which is kind of a curiosity when you think about it. This was largely due to ambivalence about what it represented. Beyond American power, and beyond the victorious end to World War II, the good war. The Enola Gay also stood for the onset of the nightmare that was the nuclear age. And so, in short, there's no way to display it without pissing off half the people, about making some people unhappy. So, but by the late 1980s, Smithsonian officials had changed their minds and decided that the time was indeed right to display the Enola Gay. In part, this was because the people who worked at the Smithsonian by then were reflecting this new critical mood about America. The 60s ethos had indeed taken effect to some degree in the Smithsonian, perhaps because many of these curators had attended graduate school and were trained by the same people who were training the historians in this new sort of social history or history from the bottom up. So they wanted to present the Enola Gay in somber fashion and perhaps even critical fashion. They decided that the exhibit was not to celebrate the atomic bombings, rather it was to be grounded in recent scholarship that questioned and debated the rationale for using the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They also wanted to give voice to the Japanese victims of the bombs. So consistent with these goals, the Air and Space curators gathered material that highlighted the fact that the bombings had always been a source of controversy. This included Admiral William Leahy and General Dwight Eisenhower's retrospective declarations that the bombings adopted, and this is in the words of Leahy, ethical standards common to barbarians in the Dark Ages. When the Enola Gay script was made public in 1994, so the script for the exhibit was made public prior to the exhibit actually being put into place in the Air and Space Museum. When it was made public, conservative veterans organizations, particularly the very large and very powerful American Legion, coordinated a highly effective campaign to block the exhibit. The leader of one such group sent letters to every member of Congress stating that it is an insult to every soldier, sailor, marine, and airman who fought in the war against Japan or who were on their way to the invasion to defame this famous plane by using it as the centerpiece of a negative exhibit on strategic bombing. Everyone's favorite radio host, Rush Limbaugh, labeled the proposed exhibit blasphemous. So this is a sort of profaning of the very idea of America. The Smithsonian caved to the backlash, which is not surprising because Congress controls the purse strings of the Smithsonian, and Congress had a lot of pressure on them, and many in Congress had very different views of how the Enola Gay should be displayed to begin with. After attempting several revised scripts that never pleased the veterans groups and never pleased Congress, the museum decided to display the Enola Gay alone without any sort of educational materials for context. So museum patrons would go and look at the plane, and they would have to decide for themselves the meaning of it. And in other words, none of their minds would be changed. They would come with one meaning and leave with the very same meaning, which sort of defeats the sort of charter purpose of the Smithsonian to educate. Critics of this proposed exhibit focused on an old argument for the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that the bombings ended the war and saved 500,000 American lives, since otherwise an invasion of the Japanese mainland would have been necessary. But historians have had long ago dismissed such figures, and so Smithsonians had based their script on numbers that of estimates made by the U.S. government prior to Hiroshima that perhaps 10 or 20,000 Americans would have died if such an invasion was indeed necessary. Moreover, to many historians, this debate about numbers, how many Americans would die if you had to invade the mainland, this debate trivialized the issue since there was a host of evidence that suggested that the U.S. knew or suspected the Japanese might have been on the verge of surrender prior to the atomic bombings. Historians, thus, were interested in much different questions about the bombings. They wanted to explore much different explanations for why Truman decided to use the bomb. Here are some of the questions they wanted the exhibit to explore. Was it to stave off the dropping of the bombs? Was it to stave off Soviet advances in East Asia? And so, in other words, is this the first moment of the Cold War? Because the Soviet Union, and I tell my students this all the time, was an American ally during World War II, because we don't think about it in such terms. Was it to protect the American monopoly on atomic weaponry, which was short-lived? Was it to avoid congressional hearings about the Manhattan Project, for which an already enormous price tag would have seemed gargantuan had the bomb remained idle? Because at that point, you only made weapons to use weapons. Luckily, during the Cold War, to some degree, that changed. Was it an act of vengeance for Pearl Harbor that was more intensely motivated by anti-Japanese racism that permeated many layers of American society during the war? So not surprisingly, these and many other plausible questions were largely ignored by Congress and in the larger national debate about the Enola Gay. When it came to American history, especially a moment that really is exalted, the end of World War II, the 60s ethos, this critical conception of American history, might have played well in historians' seminar rooms. It worked at the university. But when historians took their arguments to a wider public, they were met with scorn. Republican presidential candidate in 1996, Bob Dole, so talking in the midst of this controversy and many other history controversies, warned of the threat posed by those whom he considered intellectual elites who seemed embarrassed by America. So you have presidential candidates attacking historians. This is a really weird moment. Texas Republican Sam Johnson, who sat on the Smithsonian Board of Regents and thus had a pretty important role here, he proclaimed that the American people wanted the museum to reflect real America. So that rhetoric was not sort of founded by Sarah Palin. Real America, and not something that a historian dreamed up. Such rhetoric was common during this period of uncertainty about America's role in the world. At the end of the Cold War, there was a concerted effort by many to continue to assert American power, even though we no longer had an enemy. Necessary to this cause was a celebration of the American past, especially World War II, the good war, when Americans saved democracy for the world. Any hint of dissent from this was squashed, and to me, this really explains these history wars of the 1990s. It was a clash of cultures. But even though they were probably more intense during the 1990s, such history wars are definitely a common feature of American politics. So I'll just conclude here for those getting antsy. And then you can ask me your questions, and I can be the person squirming in my seat. Our form of democracy seems to encourage people to disagree about how to think about the nation's past. So history wars are sort of have almost always been present, and they persist. This can be seen in the recent controversy swirling around the revised framework for AP U.S. history. Advanced Placement U.S. History. I'm sure most of you know this, but I'll just sort of state it just in case. Advanced Placement U.S. History, AP U.S. History, is taught to about 500,000 American juniors every year. And they take a test, and if they pass it, they get college credit. So these are high stakes. Conservatives have reacted to this new revised framework with outrage. The Republican National Committee has charged that it reflects, quote, a radically revisionist view of American history that emphasizes negative aspects of our nation's history while omitting or minimizing positive aspects. Rush Limbaugh also told his large radio audience recently that the College Board, which is the agency that creates and administers the AP exams, is, quote, trying to take the whole concept of American exceptionalism out of the Advanced Placement History curriculum. And Rush Limbaugh has done a lot to sort of keep American exceptionalism in the conversation, not just with his radio program, but he's the author of three children's books that really are about American exceptionalism. I wonder if they're on sale here. We should check it out. In those books, he argues that America is special because it is different from all other countries in history. It is a land built on true freedom and individual liberty, and it defends both around the world. So this backlash against AP U.S. history, and it continues. The states of Oklahoma and Texas have sought to ban it entirely from the states. And I think this backlash is what motivated the conservative board in Jefferson County to create a curriculum review committee that was intended to weed out all sort of acts of rebellion from the U.S. history curriculum. I assume the original act of rebellion, the revolt against King George, is okay. That's my assumption. But all other rebels were meant to not be in the curriculum. Luckily, I would say the students fought back and defeated the conservative board for now. But this backlash should return us to the questions that animated the culture wars. Should American history make us proud of our nation's glorious past? Or should it encourage us as citizens to reflect on the complexities and even the moral failings of our nation's past? So many, if not most, university professors, like me, share the sensibilities of those 60s activists who radically challenged traditional American norms during the 60s and thus set the stage for the culture wars. Historians have increasingly analyzed the nation's past in ways that complicate this traditional American narrative. Or this narrative of American glory. This is not just a tale of progress. We understand that slavery and imperialism and other such historical blights cannot be explained away as aberrations. That is our national history. Such horrors are central to understanding American history. But in contrast, many Americans continue to think about the nation's past as a tale of national greatness. In short, this gulf between how historians tend to explain the nation's history and how many of our fellow Americans understand it has grown to immense proportions. As a result, when university historians seek to put their historical arguments into a public venue in a world beyond the ivory tower, such as when we seek to influence public school curriculum, and in fact, university historians did a lot to reshape the AP U.S. history curriculum, this clash of cultures ensues. And this is sort of typical of the culture wars, as seen in this book. An end to hostilities in these wars, history wars or culture wars, is unlikely in the foreseeable future. So we might chuckle, shake our heads at the ridiculousness when Fox News contributor Dr. Ben Carson warns that this new AP U.S. history will convince many young Americans to join ISIS. Which he said on Fox News, you know, ISIS, the Islamist group fighting for control of parts of Syria and Iraq. We might just chuckle, but we should not easily dismiss such a rationale that undergirds such outlandish sentiments. This is because such sentiments are rooted in these culture wars, which have been the defining metaphor for the United States since the 1960s. So my book tries to make sense of this war. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.